Did everybody hear that, or was that only on my phone?
Heard it.
Oh, okay, good. Okay. Hi, this is Mark Schenker, and we run the monthly Society of Addiction Psychology clinical conference call, and I'm going to make a couple of business announcements. One is that we're recording the call, and we have no way of ensuring the confidentiality, so if you are going to talk about anything clinical, please be very careful about what you say and keep it clean, okay? Second thing is please press your mute button because it tends to get really chaotic if we can hear all the background noises. I hope everybody on has been able to get a copy of the PowerPoint show. It's really great that you sent it out. And I don't know, are you willing to have people share it external to the call?
Sure. I was going to go through it quick. I couldn't remember which one I sent, but I think there's nothing. I think everything in there is just fine. So, yeah, okay. Do whatever you like with it.
Okay. And just an advance notice, we're going to have a Christmas break in December, and we're going to pick up again in January with a call on addiction medicine. But I'll do that at the end. At any rate, let me introduce Dr. Alan Budney. I first met Alan Budney as the president of Division 50, which is the Society of Addiction Psychology, who is our host today. Then I found out that he is also the past president of Division 28 of APA. He's a professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, runs an NIDA. Funded training program on the science of co-occurring disorders. He's director of the Treatment Development and Evaluation Corps for Dartmouth Center for Technology and Behavioral Health. He's done a whole lot of research on substance abuse issues or substance use disorders. I'm still behind the curve. He has a specialty in cannabis use disorders. He was a member of the DSM-5 Substance Use Disorders Working Group. And he's been on numerous review boards, including NIH grant review committees and so forth. So we're very lucky to have him join us today, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Good afternoon, everybody, or whatever time of day it is, wherever you are. I'm pleased to have a chance to speak with you today, and hopefully this becomes a very interactive session because I sent out this large PowerPoint file, but I don't have any intention of going through it systematically in any respect. I just thought I get asked to give talks on various aspects of marijuana quite often, so I was trying to find a comprehensive slideshow that touches on all the things that the folks practicing clinically might be most interested in, and so I picked this one. Mostly to stimulate questions on your part to give you a feel for how I think about things or questions you can ask, because mostly I want to try to answer questions. It's always interesting to talk to a clinical audience that's practicing because typically you're going to ask questions that there are not answers to. So it's probably very dissatisfying to talk to somebody like me, but hopefully I have a few insights or some pieces of knowledge that can help you. But trying to make some clinical decisions about things that relate to this medical marijuana issue, to how to deal with ambivalence, et cetera, there's never any great black and white answers, but certainly worth discussion and to hear from others. So anyway, Mark told you about my background. I've been at it for a while, and I've been focused on marijuana in my clinical research for, I don't know, maybe 20 or 25 years now. So I stay on top of most everything in the field on marijuana, the parts that I can understand anyway. And so you can see in the slideshow, if you had a chance to look at it, no real disclosures because I don't do this. Corporations or anything, but I do get my money from NIDA. So that's always a potential.
Alan, could I interrupt? Someone doesn't have the mute on, and there's a lot of background noise, so please be careful to put your mute button on. Thanks.
Mayor, I think you got it. I think. Something going on still there. But anyway, I get money from NIDA to do my research, and it helps travel funds, et cetera, like that. So that's, to some degree, people consider that a conflict of interest to some degree that you should disclose, because marijuana tends to be controversial and people think you're either for it or against it, et cetera. My position is... Oh, there's some loud noise there. I'm not sure where that's coming from, but... Anyway, my position on marijuana is my area of interest is to primarily help people that are looking to stop using, that have gotten themselves into trouble. That's where my research focus has been primarily. That doesn't mean I have any strong opinions about marijuana as a recreational substance, a medical substance, etc. I pretty much am an empiricist and look to the data to help me guide decisions, mostly common sense, even more so than the data. So where I thought I might start today, and you'll see, like, if you go to, like, slide 4, that says the goals and conclusions. That's not necessarily for today. Maybe we'll get to that a bit. But mostly my goals for today are to answer some of your questions and stimulate your thinking and get you to think hard about this topic and realize that a lot of it is good clinical judgment, along with trying to learn as much as you can to inform your clinical judgment. So that said, I am, Mark, I'm not sure how we should structure this, but what I was going to do is I was going to actually respond to a few questions that people sent ahead of time as a jumping off point to start a discussion. And after I respond to the question in whatever way I can, I'm happy to take a follow-up question to it, hear some comments, et cetera, and generate a discussion. And if it's going on too long, I'll try to cut it off and move on. Sound good?
That sounds perfect.
Okay. All right, because I always say I don't talk much, but I end up talking and talking and talking. So anyway, the first question I got, and I'll go in order just because I think that's the appropriate things to do. Someone sent in a clinical question that they're treating a couple people in their 50s that have been smoking marijuana for a long time. And both patients or clients say they use marijuana to help them reduce stress and to stay calm. And one of the people has started to have some extreme anxiety attacks or panic attacks. And it's hard to tell if they started before, they're part of a withdrawal syndrome, or what's going on there. And so it's kind of, the question is a little bit about the relationship between cannabis use or marijuana use and anxiety. And that's a great question, because we're in a time now where people, certainly when we talk about therapeutic use of marijuana, one of the things that's not been approved for in any state that I know of, but what it's certainly talked about in psychology and psychiatric clinics, is people use it to deal with anxiety. What do we know about that? Well, I wish we knew more, but we know that there's a relationship between cannabis use and greater levels of anxiety disorders. So people that are using cannabis regularly have greater levels of anxiety disorders than people that aren't in general population. And that's not a causal relationship necessarily, but that's kind of what we know. We know that cannabis in the laboratory, if you just have somebody smoke it, traditionally doesn't, on average, provoke anxiety or really reduce anxiety that much. It's relatively neutral in that area. But where they haven't really tested it in the laboratory in any systematic way is with people with already high levels of anxiety or abnormally low levels of anxiety. So we really don't know how people with anxiety conditions respond to cannabis acutely. We do know that some people have acute panic reactions or paranoid reactions when they use marijuana, and that's usually naive users and is somewhat related potentially to high dose THC as well in some more recent situations where there's high-dose marijuana out there, high-dose cannabis. So I wish I had a better answer for you. If I was going to guess, if someone has a severe anxiety problem when they stop using, it is doubtful that it is a straight-up withdrawal response. People do report some anxiety when they withdraw, but on average, I think that's primarily, my guess would be, it's primarily has to do with they're fairly anxious people to start with, and they're basically messing with their homeostatic situation, which was they were smoking marijuana, and whatever that was doing to their psychosocial functioning, you take that away, you can expect things to change, and probably change in the exacerbating whatever problems they kind of generally have below the typical marijuana state. So I don't know if that's clear, but I kind of think that's the way it works with depression and anxiety. And certainly you can perceive that it gives you relief, because I'm sure it does in some situations and for some people. Would you call that a medicine for anxiety? Well, you know, almost all drugs, alcohol, anything sedating a little bit can make you feel less anxious and more calm. So in a sense, it's symptomatic treatment, but is it really treatment in the sense of that we think about with psychological treatments or pharmacotherapies? I think that's a stretch at this point. Some people think that cannabidiol, which is one of the compounds in the cannabis plant that's at various levels in the types of cannabis you smoke, has some sedative or anxiolytic properties, but we don't know that. The literature, people write about it as if they really, we've studied that in any way, meaningful way, and we have not. There's no clinical laboratory or clinical trials that give you any really good data on what cannabidiol may or may not be good for. It's certainly possible, but it's not in any way, shape, or form something you'd want to bet any money on at this point. So I will stop right there and look for comments or follow-up questions.
Well, I'd like you to follow your slides. I'm looking at them, and they're so interesting.
Well, I could do that, but that's like going to be an hour lecture.
That's okay.
Well, we can get back to that if the rest of the folks would like me to do that. So,
I had a question about that. Is there a dose effect in terms of anxiety or any other psychological effect there?
Well, there's definitely a dose effect, but its impact on anxiety is basically unknown. The higher the dose, again, they haven't studied folks that are already in an anxious state to see if it functions as an anxiolytic in the laboratory. So you haven't used it with people with anxiety disorders in any systematic way. And certainly none of the therapeutic calls for it have any dosing ideas as well. You would think small doses would be better, because once you get to higher doses, pretty much you're high and more sedated, and perhaps getting some of the anxiogenic effects, but we really don't know.
What about over time? Do you have any data on that? Like, I've heard of people who have found it initially very calming, but over using over a couple of years have gotten much more paranoid or irritable on using it.
Yeah, the same thing. That's very idiosyncratic. You'll hear people tell you the exact opposite, and there's no data to inform that in the slightest. So that's kind of what I told you. When you get to these kind of clinical scenarios, there aren't going to be great answers for you. I think knowing that we're not sure, and certainly no one's shown that it works that way, pharmacologically, you wouldn't necessarily think it would work that way. But marijuana, like any other drug, doesn't work in a vacuum. It interacts with other substances. It interacts with the individual. Individuals react differently to substances quite a bit, and different patterns of tolerance, et cetera. And you put that together with the dose and what we don't even know what's in the marijuana on the streets in terms of what what proportions of different compounds are in the cannabis that you smoke versus the cannabis that I smoke versus the person in Hawaii or California.
So, Alan, this is Deborah Haller. How you doing? Since you're talking about comorbidity, I wonder if you might want to speak to emerging psychosis in young adults?
Oh, yeah, that's always a very hot topic. It's a little tricky. I think there's been a lot of research on this. So what Deborah's referring to, if everybody's not familiar with that, is that there is quite a bit of data gathering that is concerning that cannabis can instigate, stimulate, cause psychosis. And what is unknown or what we wonder about is it initiating psychosis in people that would have never become psychotic or developed a psychotic type disorder? Who's vulnerable? Does it really trigger a disorder that does not revert or remit? And the data there, I mean, there are quite a good few good review articles to read about this that just came out. But in my reading of the literature and the way I think about this is certainly there is a small risk of having a psychotic episode compared to never using marijuana at all in people between the age, 16 to 21. So that's kind of a documented statistical fact. Then there's the causal piece. All right. It seems to be that it's most likely going to occur in people that they think were susceptible to having a psychotic type disorder like schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder eventually. So they have a bunch of risk factors or prodromal type syndrome. I know you will also see it in some cases in people that do not have any of those risk factors for having a psychotic type disorder. And what you'd think you'd be able to tease apart is that if they're the people that weren't really going to ever develop psychosis, that you would see it remit more likely than the people that don't, or the people that do have those risk factors. But we really have not been able to put our finger on that. There's lots of different types of longitudinal designs that people have looked at. And long and the short, they'll certainly say that ongoing use of marijuana is not good for somebody with a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia, and that it'll result in more relapse and poor outcomes over time. They will say that it does increase the risk of having an acute psychotic episode, but less certainty is there that it'll increase the risk of having a psychotic episode that will endure. The last piece to comment on in that area is that some data suggests that use of high-potency marijuana with high levels of THC, is what makes it risky for a psychotic episode, emerging psychosis. The data there are very clear in terms of it being a risk factor, or a predictor. It's not clear if it really is the high-dose THC or not, but my reading of that literature is, I'd stay away from that high-dose stuff if you have a vulnerability or concerned about that at this point in time. But I think nobody's really replicated those results very well. But there's a study from England that shows that this shows the strong relationship between an emerging psychosis and use of cannabis. And then they look within the cannabis users at what they've used and how much they've used, and it's regular use of high-potency THC that is related to the increased risk for psychosis and earlier onset. So there's a long kind of babbling answer, but I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Now, the person who asked before about following slides, was there a specific piece of something there you wanted me to comment on?
Well, most of it. I want to know, is it have an addictive potential?
I hear you. So let's go there, because I think the next question that's here, the next two questions that I have from people, or three questions, are this. A question about diagnosing abuse and dependence, treatment issues and treatment options, and news on the pharmacotherapy front. So those are all sort of related. So maybe for that, I will kind of look to my slides, because they're probably okay here. So if you go to slide, this is number 7, it says, we know that cannabis use can develop into an addiction. I was asked to give a talk down at NIH about cannabis and addiction, on what we know and what we don't know. And I don't necessarily like using the word addiction. That's why I put it in quotes. But anyway, cannabis use can develop into a cannabis use disorder just like any other substance. The probability is a little bit lower than some of the other substances like cocaine and heroin, but the prevalence is higher because more people use it. And then the next statement I have there is cannabis use disorder is not qualitatively different. And what I mean by that, if you look at the next couple, the next few slides kind of get at that, is there's been a whole slew of research on, if you're doing diagnostic clinical epidemiology, where you're doing diagnostic surveys and looking at the different criteria that make up a use disorder diagnosis, you see all the same things being ticked off for people with cannabis use as you do for alcohol or heroin or cocaine. They meet all the different criteria in there are knocked off. What you get is usually a little bit less severe syndrome than for cocaine or opiate use disorder, but still you get up into the severe level. But probably generally, if you said on average how severe is a cannabis use disorder versus a cocaine use disorder, the cannabis one would probably be a little bit less severe with slightly less consequences, but still quite substantial for the individual. So there's been lots of, again, diagnostic surveys like that. Large population-based surveys, smaller clinical surveys, et cetera. And they all come out and pretty much say the same thing. A cannabis use disorder is remarkably similar to other types of use disorders. What else do I like to point out about that? That sometimes gets us to the idea of withdrawal, because for some folks, some lay folks and some scientists hang their hat on a substance showing withdrawal when they discontinue it abruptly as a real marker for addiction. And I don't know if I buy that or not, but certainly it's part of most use disorders. People, a certain proportion of people that develop use disorder have some substantial withdrawal, but not everybody. And I studied this in the laboratory for quite a while, and it was pretty clear over time, and then you can look again at the next set of slides there going through probably 10 to 18 or so, you'll see a bunch of withdrawal slides. And over time in the laboratory, we showed that cannabis withdrawal, when it occurs, looks remarkably like tobacco withdrawal. Same types of symptoms generally. The effect on appetite is in the opposite direction. But other than that, pretty similar magnitude, severity, et cetera, et cetera. And people complain about it when they stop. Not everybody, but not everybody complains about tobacco withdrawal or even opiate withdrawal. People don't realize that. So, and we've studied heavy users. This isn't everybody that's smoking regularly is going to go through withdrawal, but a good proportion of people are. And if you gave them oral THC, the active ingredient in cannabis, you can reduce their withdrawal or eliminate their withdrawal just like you can with a nicotine replacement therapy. With this audience, a clinical audience, I'm kind of known out there in the science world as the guy that was one of the people that was very influential in establishing cannabis withdrawal. And to some degree, I regret that, because I also, as a clinician, think withdrawal is the least of our worries in trying to help somebody with a cannabis use disorder. We can help them get through the initial stages of quitting for a day or two or three or four. The problem, like all other substance use disorders, is it sneaks back in there and you get relapse. So there is a withdrawal syndrome, which makes it just like the other use disorders, and there are ways to help people through withdrawal, either perhaps with medications or just with some good behavioral and educational strategies and changing of expectations. But that doesn't necessarily lead to better outcomes for people that are really looking to quit. And that kind of leads us to the treatment issues. And well, let me stop there for a second before we talk about treatment. Questions or comments about that aspect of cannabis?
Alan, this is Keith Fallone out in Los Angeles. We just legalized marijuana on Tuesday, which I'm not
very
happy about.
Congratulations.
It's a good business opportunity for us out here anyway. So very interested in learning more about, and I've read your research for years, so very happy to have you speak. I'm just interested at some point if you can talk to us about pharmacology in terms of what seems to be effective in terms of mitigating against the withdrawal symptoms. So whether you do it now or later in this talk, I would appreciate it.
Okay, yep, we're about to get to that. Any other comments in this area? I can move to that pretty quickly.
I have a question about the slides themselves. Many of them have references, citations on them, but I didn't see a slide that actually lists all those references. Would you be able to send them to us so we can follow up on a lot of the things you're talking about?
I could, yeah. There's not a slide in there that does that. That's kind of it's a good point, but that's how most presentations get set up. They rarely show you the references at the end. Uh-oh, somebody's music song. There you go. Yeah, I can do that. If Mark reminds me to, I can try to dig through this, or you can send me an email directly, and I'm happy to send you any references. It's a very quick response.
You know, the easiest thing, Alan, would be if you would send it to me, and then I can distribute it to the list.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll send you a reminder.
So pharmacotherapy, that was the question. I'm looking to see if there's a slide on that. Here we go. If you just go to, I have one slide on it. Slide 31. Now, just last week or the week before, I was part of a symposium at ACAP, which is the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and I was to discuss it on the pharmacotherapy for cannabis use disorders update kind of thing. So I'm pretty up to date on this. So it's kind of, it could be a whole lecture in itself, but actually, go back, maybe forward. Hold on. Maybe this will do it. Okay, this will do it. Yes, slide 31 is good. Most of the pharmacotherapy laboratory studies and trials have really targeted withdrawal. That's kind of to some degree why I would regret being part of the withdrawal movement, because that always leads to medications. And so we're spending a lot of money on medication research, which is good, but we're not finding much. What we're finding is pretty clearly, if you use an agonist, which is kind of an obvious thing, and an agonist meaning oral THC, which could be Marinol in a pill form or dronabinol, and they're trying also some other ones in the laboratory that aren't available for sale, but you could also, in Canada, you can get Nabiximols that are a combination of THC and cannabidiol. And all of those, when administered in, you know, not very super high levels, but at certain levels, you can reduce withdrawal. I mean, it's just almost a no-brainer. The key is, can you reduce withdrawal without getting a person too high? So you have to watch out for that. And that varies certainly on tolerance levels. But no one has yet to show that using an antagonist for withdrawal in a clinical trial leads to better outcomes, you know, 12, 16 weeks later. I guess it's time for a break. Hello? Can everybody hear me? Are we being put on hold?
Hardly.
A number of people didn't mute their phones.
Mark, we think that's part of the idea.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to do. I mean, if you're having music in the background, just put your mute key.
Could be a protest.
Could be what? Sounds like the kind of music when somebody is on hold. I wonder if somebody went on hold.
Yeah, I don't know.
Alan, talk loudly over it.
I can try.
Is there any point in everyone muting or taking the phone off mute, putting it back on again?
That's not a bad idea.
I think you're right, Mark. I bet somebody went on hold. All right.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Let's just.
Okay, whoever just came back on from being on hold.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to do about this. Again, if you're out there listening, please turn it on mute.
I think you have to disconnect the call and dial back in.
I'm willing to do that.
People want to do that?
How about everyone disconnect and call back in?
Okay.
All right. Let's do that. Okay, bye.
Arsenia Izzard.
Deborah
Howard.
Diane Palavchuk.
Arsenia Izzard.
Damaris Rosenau.
Hi, Damaris.
Okay. Alan, you on?
I'm on.
Steve Lissman.
Arsenia Izzard.
Michael Helfer.
James. Hey, Mark Shanker. Hey, Mark.
Yeah.
Bruce here. Hey, I wanted to try to help you figure out who that was, so I stayed on the line, and I'll tell you, the music stopped even though, I mean, everybody came into the exact same conference call, so I would recommend right now, since the music has stopped, that we explain what probably just happened. So the music ended even without the call ending, because I've been on it.
Ah, okay. Well, could have been somebody then.
It may have ended, though, because we terminated the call.
No, I stayed on the call. I've never gotten off.
Yeah, the recording is continuous. Well, hopefully it won't happen again, and why don't we pick up where we left off, Alan?
It's a new form of teleconference heckling, I think.
But everybody should know, do not use the hold function on your phone if you're changing calls.
Yeah. Thanks, Bruce.
You learn something every time.
Hey, Alan, when you're ready for another question, I know you're going to be talking about some other things, but I'll
this time,
put in my...
Please, everyone, mute if you're not talking, because last time I was hearing a lot of typing and breathing.
Okay.
And paper shuffling.
Alan, if I could just follow up on the question.
Someone send around the slides or let us know how to access the slides that have been referenced.
Mark sent those out, so if you got an email.
I sent them out. Some people didn't get them because it was large, but I made a PDF out of it. So if you want to real quickly email me your email, send me an email and I will send you out the slides on PDF.
All right, I don't have your email, and someone forwarded me information about the conference, but not any slides.
Yeah. And I can send the slides. I can send the slides to people later. I'm not really going over them in too much detail, so you really won't miss much at this point. I was just orienting myself, actually, more so than other things for the talk. But let me keep going.
This is Keith Vallone speaking. I want to ask about the pharmacology. I know people don't want to spend the whole time on it, but let me just make a comment on it. The reason that it's interesting to me, we treat a lot of cannabis dependence, and actually we're primary mental health and co-occurring. One of the reasons why it's interesting to me is because it's an issue of getting people into treatment. Obviously, it's not going to be the end-all for treatment, but so often we have difficulty getting people into treatment because of the withdrawal syndrome, which is robust. And then trying to help people enter treatment and then, stay in treatment, just getting through that withdrawal period. I was just wondering that if there were any ways to, ease the period of withdrawal either CB1 agonists or antagonists or whatever. I was just curious
I hear you. I think that's an important point. I think you got to get people through that, especially if it's pretty severe from their perspective. And I think at this point, the recommendation to some degree is you can try an agonist and work with that if you want to follow them closely with that. Other than that, the way I've worked with it clinically, the larger summary is people have tried all the usual suspects that they've tried for cocaine and alcohol, et cetera, and have yet to find a substance that has much of a robust effect. So you can go through bupropion. Gabapentin seems to maybe have a little bit of an effect because it's sedative. So pretty much, if you think symptoms, I think that's the best, most effective way at the moment to try to help your individual patient through. For example, if they really can't sleep and they're telling you, my problem, doc, is I can't sleep, so I got to get high, a sleep medication and sleep hygiene makes sense. If they really have an appetite problem, which some of them really do, what else can you use to stimulate appetite or have nausea like Compazine or something? I've talked to primary care docs about dietary to quit, and here's the symptom. Can you prescribe this for a week or so? But in very symptom-specific, because other than the agonists, again, maybe gabapentin has a little bit of data behind it. There's nothing there to recommend with any confidence for a general population of cannabis users. So it's more.
How about naltrexone?
Naltrexone has some interesting data, not necessarily much on withdrawal, but on how they experience when they use marijuana. So it's kind of like with alcohol a little bit.
Yeah.
But the effect isn't really strong, and it's not really quite clear whether to give a higher dose or a lower. But you can play around with that clinically, but probably not for withdrawal. I wouldn't suggest that would be the way you go.
More relapse prevention.
Yeah, if they're just trying to, find a way so they don't enjoy it quite as much. You'd probably, if you did a really good trial with an opioid antagonist, if you got anything, it would probably be a reduction in the amount they use, not much on abstinence.
But it would be worth maybe a trial with Vivitrol, for example.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
And data supports that.
Thank you very much, yeah.
Okay, so that's pharmacotherapies. Any other follow-ups on pharmacotherapy? To be honest, there's a lot of work. There's a bunch of really good reviews that just came out, 2015, 2016. If you look at the literature on a Google search, et cetera, and you say pharmacotherapy for cannabis use disorder, you'll get a five-page synopsis that'll bring you right up to speed. And there's a few good ones that are easy to read. What else? Treatment issues in general. And if you do have slides, I'm on the wrong place here. Right after that, which is slide 32, I started to review the adult treatment literature. And the adult treatment literature, again, in a very quick general form, pretty much is like what you see for alcohol or for cocaine, in that, and maybe even smoking, tobacco smoking, MET, CBT, contingency management, combinations thereof, coping skills type therapies. They've all been tried in various durations and lengths and intensities, and generally are efficacious. And people have, like me, have transformed some of the CBT to be delivered by a computer and things. Same thing is being done in other areas. And so you get some effect. It is definitely worth doing, and you can help a certain segment of the population. The next slide, which is 33, I always put that in there just to show you the magnitude of the effect. Pretty much the way I think about it, you know, between 25 and 45% of the people you make significant progress with, and it lasts out to 6 to 12 months. That's as far as we've really tested it. But so using the traditional behavioral type therapies gets you about that magnitude of effect. And with motivational interviewing, it's lower. If you combine motivational interviewing and CBT, it's a little higher. If you add contingency management, you can get more abstinence from a larger proportion of your sample. But again, lots of people are left behind, and lots of people relapse. So kind of the same state of the art, really, at this point as other types of substance use disorders. And there's a number of pretty good manuals out there you can get your hands on if you like to do manual-based therapy to follow for this type of thing. And for kids, substance use disorders have been studied more generally rather than really parsing out cannabis use disorder. There's only been one or two trials that really say this is for cannabis use disorder. But most of the substance use disorder treatment literature for adolescents has primarily cannabis users in it, that being the primary substance. And the number of different family therapies, individually based MET, CBT, contingency management, again, all those types of things seem to work pretty, I don't want to say pretty well, but they have demonstrated efficacy for this population. But again, a lot of room for improvement. And again, for the adolescents, probably even more so than adults, there's a number of really good manuals you can get your hands on for free that can help guide you for a strategy to deal with substance use disorder and cannabis in particular with kids. I think we can do a lot better, and we need to keep trying to do better. And we've been working on some things to add to the traditional treatments, like really going after self-regulatory skills or inhibitory control or working executive function improvements. So lots of things you can try, but what we have now is, you know, a number of good choices of treatments to use to get a decent effect in a portion of the population. So I'm going to stop there for treatment and take questions or comments or follow-ups.
Alan, do you mean about anything or about treatment or?
We can move on.
Well, I don't want to.
We only have 15 minutes left or so we can move on to another topic. We didn't get
to
therapeutic marijuana yet, so that's good.
Okay, so the literature is pretty clear, I believe. Please correct me if I'm wrong, about the correlation between performance in adolescence and marijuana use or marijuana use problems. We have some really good data and trying to figure out what we can do as a follow-up to really try to figure out which kids get in trouble with marijuana and ultimately have problems in school. Wondering about moderators versus mediators. We're wondering specifically about whether or not it's a conformity issue. And so anything about conformity and marijuana use in adolescence, anything about effects on academic performance, anything on parents' degree of conformity, all that stuff is what we're trying to make sense of right now.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the conformity construct, I don't know a lot about and haven't paid too much attention to it and don't know what the literature really looks like, and even if there is a substantial literature with kids. Certainly all the usual risk factors for going on to develop a problem are there with cannabis, which is just earlier onset and other types of externalizing disorders like ADHD or conduct disorder, sensation seeking, all those typical things are there.
I think one of the things that appears to be occurring, and I absolutely don't have any data on this, is it appears to be that marijuana is different from alcohol in that it doesn't seem like there is an alcohol culture among kids. It can be kids from any walk of life, anything, but it seems like marijuana is part of some
right
youth subcultures. Hipsters or
right.
whatever. But we don't have data on it. That's what we're wondering.
Yeah, I don't think and there may be some out there, some good social psychology data, but I don't know if there's data. I think what you're asking is if kids identify with the culture, are they more at risk for longer-term problems, that cannabis culture versus kids that are using that don't, I guess, is the question.
Exactly. Because I don't recall any alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think, and the interesting piece will be to some degree is as marijuana moves forward and becomes legal in this country, which it looks like we're heading that way, that subculture may to some degree go away because the subculture probably was part of it in a sense being an illegal clandestine product compared to alcohol, but maybe not. But those are the types of things that may change and impact things like risk factors and impact prevention strategies, and perhaps make our prevention strategies more effective if it's legal because you don't have this subculture fight back. You know, it's kind of like now it's just you can't argue about legalization. You just have to argue about harm or not. So I'm in a sense looking forward to see if we do better job with prevention in a new regulatory environment than we have in the past when it was illegal. Well, we might do worse, but it's also possible maybe we'll do better.
That's all very helpful, and I appreciate it. And is marijuana use in adults related to more liberal, more conservative?
I don't know. I really haven't. I would think more liberal, but I don't really know.
Do you have some thoughts about the increasing legalization of recreational and medicinal use from state to state? How do you think that's going to impact, harmful use and so on?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. How's legalization going to impact problems? Everything that we know about how the factors about how problems develop and why they develop and factors that influence it, like availability, access, potency, marketing, all those things argue that, hey, if there's no way in hell it's going to get better, and it can seem to only get worse. Price will likely go down. People that weren't using because it was just its legal status, that'll go away and more people will use it, perhaps use more because you don't have to keep it under wraps. So all those factors would translate into you'd see one more people trying it and using it, and there's no reason to think the proportion wouldn't go up at least a little bit in terms of people that develop problems. So overall, you would have more people with problems, which is kind of what we've been seeing over the last 10 years, is that we have more people using, especially not the youngest groups, but actually the not quite middle age, a little bit younger than middle age. That's the group that's escalating their use the most at the moment. And you also have more people developing cannabis use problems, but proportionally it's a little bit less than it used to be because some of the people that are coming on board with using are people that aren't as at risk for developing a problem. I'm not sure that makes sense, but if you think about it, if a drug is illegal, the people that tend to use it already have some of the risk factors for developing a problem on board, like externalizing, because you have to kind of break the law and be devious and everything. And none of those things are all risk factors for overuse and misuse and those type of problems. But once a drug becomes legal, say like alcohol, there's plenty of people that drink, and now there'll be more people that smoke marijuana that don't have the other underlying risk factors for problem development. So that seems to be what we're seeing in the data. You know, what most people are most worried about is kids, and how will this influence kids? And I certainly know the things to worry about. We don't have great data yet, but the things to worry about are, I don't know, a bunch. I'll list a few of them. One is new forms of, not only will it not be illegal just in society, I know it'll still be illegal for kids, but that change in society impacts the way they perceive the drug and access to the drug. But these new types of marijuana that are being developed, higher potency products, edible products, and vaping products, using a vaporizer, they all also make it easier to initiate use. And some have more concerns about what happens when you first initiate use. Because smoking marijuana, like smoking tobacco, having to smoke something is noxious to a good portion of the population. So they don't, you know, they delay it, they don't really want to do it, et cetera, or they don't like it when they first try it, which is, has a lot to do with what goes on from there. And so if you make products and the first thing you do is eat a candy bar or a lollipop or a soda or vape it with flavors, you remove all the noxious parts of the substance and substance use and just leave the getting high part, which is usually the part most people like. Some people don't, but most people do. So that vulnerability at that early initiation stage is what I worry about with kids. And this idea of the vaping phenomena of starting off with vaping, just flavors and things, you can add either nicotine or cannabis products to vaping products, also makes you a little wary that we might not see age of initiation of marijuana be earlier than it has been in the past. I don't think we've really quite seen that yet in the data, but we do know that early initiation is a predictor of problems later on. And it's also more problematic for things like brain development. So if anything, we've always been striving in prevention to get kids to wait till later to try marijuana or any other drug. And the longer you can get them to delay, the better off you are in terms of probability of developing problems. So that's where I have my most concerns about. I also wonder sometimes about the elderly and whether they will start to try it and it'll have some physical impact with them, perhaps a positive impact, but also some negative possibilities with cognitive function.
Thank you.
Sure. Follow-ups to that or other things related to that? One of the things I wanted to address was somebody wrote a question. I'm trying to get back to the questions because I feel bad if I didn't get to them. Somebody asked about, and I don't know how familiar people are with this, is that they wanted me to comment on the sativa indica controversy. That is the different types of cannabis out there and what their effects are. So for those of you who aren't aware, in the therapeutic marijuana world, or even just the recreational world to some degree, people argue and profess to know that this type of marijuana called either sativa or indica or this ratio of THC to CBD will either make you mellow or stimulate you or be good for stress or et cetera, et cetera. And so if you actually go to some dispensaries where they display and basically consult with you on what you might use for your condition, they will push things that way. Oh, for that, you should use this strain because people find this is really good for X, Y, or Z. We have no data on that. Zero. And, you know, they may be right. I never say people are wrong, but we don't have any data whatsoever to help guide us there. We even have pretty weak data on just understanding the compounds and their known effects in putting together recommendations like that just based on what we would know from their mechanism of action. So there's some things you can say and project from mechanism of action, but even there, it's very unclear, and there's very few studies, particularly with humans, where they have various ratios of THC to cannabidiol and have different things like terpenoids controlled for or not. So there's all this junk in marijuana that may or may not contribute to its effect, and then you have to worry about the effect on a given individual. And a given individual, like I started to say before, that this tends to be anxious versus tends to be depressed versus tends to be stressed out, that drug interacts with that individual differently than it interacts with somebody who doesn't have those characteristics. That's just the nature of drugs that go into the brain. So anyway, the answer to that is, and I think the article that was passed along by Ethan Russo pretty much says, we don't know what we're doing. And don't go with those recommendations. And you don't know what's even in the marijuana until somebody analyzes it. And then once they analyze it, you still won't know what direction the effects might be in. So that's my answer to that question. We have a few more minutes. Anybody else have a pressing question they really want to get to, or they'll be very disappointed? We don't want anybody to be disappointed. There was a therapeutic question about, are there recommendations on differentiating ADHD symptoms from marijuana intoxication or withdrawal? I found that question to be fascinating. I've never heard that one before. I've been asked if whether or not cannabis might be good for ADHD, but not whether how you could differentiate the symptoms. So I hadn't thought much about it. I can't imagine intoxication or withdrawal look much like ADHD, but you would have somebody that's, if they're in withdrawal, they could be irritable, et cetera. That's not necessarily what ADHD kids look like. They could be a little bit restless, but it's not usually a major symptom. But certainly certainly with my studies with adults, when we put them into withdrawal in laboratory studies, they can be a pain in the ass to be around. We've had spouses call up and say, please let him go back to smoking. I can't take it anymore. Because people do get irritable and withdrawn and all kinds of things. But, and again, different things for different people. So it can be difficult. You do, I guess, just like any other withdrawal syndrome, if you're trying to diagnose a psychiatric disorder, be very conscious of what else is going on in their lives and make sure it's not withdrawing from caffeine and they're having headaches, or with cannabis, if it's just happened to, you know, a few days ago, wait a week or two, bring them back in. So that's probably not a great answer, but...
Could you say a little bit about vaping as a harm reduction method? Because what we're hearing anecdotally out here in California is that the effects are a little bit milder from vaping versus smoking.
Okay, good. That's a great question. Here's how I think about vaping, and we wrote a little editorial on this. It's published in Addiction last year. Vaping for cannabis, vaping typically, the harm reduction piece of vaping is typically thought of non-combustible smoke, or you're inhaling aerosol rather than combustible smoke. So you're not getting all the carcinogens. So for marijuana, there's lots of carcinogens when you burn it. And so when you vape it, you will, if you use a good vaporizer, reduce the carcinogenic substances that come into your body by a good deal. But nowadays, one of the things to be wary of, some of these vaping...
This is Natalie.
These cheapo vapo things may not do such a good job of really... protecting folks. That's just an aside. The bit about, so that's where it's a harm reduction thing. All it is harm reduction on your lungs, which isn't, you know, something to throw away. But with cannabis, the real problem with cannabis that we've always been worried about are its acute effects. So what happens when you're intoxicated and you develop a problem, a habit, an addiction, whatever you want to call it? That, I do not think, is mitigated at all by vaping. No data to show that it's milder. Some people think it delivers a more intense effect. Some people say it's more efficient, which is kind of, again, a little bit of a risk factor. Once you start making it easier to use, less costly, those are all things that really generate more use. And the more you use, the more likely you are to develop. So I don't perceive at this point, any harm reduction effects on the addictive possibilities or the intoxicating possibilities at all. I do see some harm reduction impact on lung. So for cigarettes and vaping and e-cigs, that's the whole ball of wax, right? If you can get rid of the combustible smoke, then you've got huge harm reduction, because for tobacco, most of the worst effects on the lungs and cancer, nicotine isn't so worrisome. But for vaping cannabis, I don't think it applies quite so much at all.
Can I ask a question regarding this? Actually, my name is Colin Keller, and I thought the original question was regarding harm reduction from going from smoking marijuana to vaping nicotine or vaping just flavors, because that is very common in my program.
Yeah, well, that would be – yes, I would – there I would agree that vaping flavors, if you stop smoking marijuana and start vaping flavors and you maintain it, that's huge. I can't, you know, that would be a great stride for me clinically. Now, we don't really know about long-term medical effects of vaping forever, so you've got to worry about that a little bit. But if you're getting off a substance and vaping a non-intoxicating substance, you know, that's got to be progress in the right direction. Hopefully we don't learn in 30 years that somehow all these aerosols that we vape somehow do something bad to us, but we probably won't know for a while.
Thank you.
Yes, I didn't think that was the question, but if that's the direction of the question, I would agree with you completely.
Folks, this is Mark Schenker again, and we're out of time. I don't know, Alan, if you want to stay on and answer more questions, that's fine with me.
I haven't got anywhere to run. So I have a few more minutes if anybody has a pressing question they want to discuss.
Well, even if someone has more, that's great. But thank you so much, Alan. That was wonderful.
You're welcome.
And all it did was prompt more questions on my end, so maybe we'll have you back sometime.
Yeah, I'd like I said, it's hard to get the questions answered, and it's hard to get through long slideshows as well. So I'm happy to be around to answer questions by email as well. So just let folks know.
Thank you so much. Just a reminder, there is no call next month. I know it's going to break our hearts across the country, but I'm taking a vacation. And, again, thanks so much for the talk.
All right.
Yeah, Alan, thank you. That was terrific.
Oh,
thanks. Thank you, Alan.
You're welcome. Glad you could join.